Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Gelton, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. No food is arguably more central to human existence than milk. The ancients honored it as a symbol of nature and maternity. As societies evolved, the production and use of milk developed alongside. In the story of milk today, we see bigger forces at work, from the debate over family farming to the importance of government regulation. This hour, On Point, milk through the ages. You can join the conversation. What does milk mean to you? Is it part of your daily diet? Have you thought about where it comes from? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook, at On Point Radio. Joining me now is Deborah Valenzi, professor of history at Barnard College. Her new book, Milk, A Local and Global History, comes out today. Deborah, congratulations.
Thank you. Welcome
to On Point.
Thank you, Tom.
Let's go all the way back to ancient times. At what point did humans begin really honoring milk as a symbol, and what do we know now about how they felt about milk thousands of years ago?
Well, we know from evidence that milk was a symbol because we have statues of gods and goddesses, particularly Isis, the great mother, holding the infant Horus and nursing him. A powerful and common image in the Middle East thousands of years before the Christian era. And we also have evidence in ancient epics, the Gilgamesh epic, for example, in which Gilgamesh and his men discover Enkidu, this shaggy, barbaric creature who's in his lair, busy doing dairy work. The first thing that happens to him is that he's civilized and made to stop drinking milk, because that's what uncivilized people do.
What does that mean about the way milk was seen? Why was it even back then seen as something that symbolized, what would you say, nature as opposed to civilization?
Exactly. Milk really was nature. It was a product of animals' bodies as well as women's bodies. And this image of milking animals in the rough was very much a sign of a kind of nomadic existence that was carried on by barbaric peoples. Very early on in ancient history, for example, the Greeks understood that settled agriculture, was a feature of civilized society. And so they used the trope of the dairy as a contrast. You know, this is what we don't do. This is what barbaric people do.
But at some point, people began raising cows, right? Grazing cows for milk.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's taken historians a long time to recognize that grazing cows is not necessarily a nomadic activity. Mm-hmm. You know, it's something integrated into settled agriculture. But historians were still in need of this contrast. You know, that's how historians teach, too. Mm-hmm. And so very much in the literature, the idea of pastoral agriculture was written in as something less civilized.
Now, so for many human societies, at least in certain areas and in certain classes, once people were weaned from mother's milk, they stopped drinking milk.
Yes and no. Milk was always seen as a food of sustenance, something good for growth. And so children were thought to drink milk, even in ancient times. The elderly drank milk. Mm-hmm. Because it strengthened, it nourished. And medical understandings of the human body understood that children and the elderly were cold, and milk being a cold product, as it was seen in Galenic terms, harmonized with their beings. So children and the elderly would have had some contact with it. But when you were in normal life, you know, in a you know, a state of adulthood, you probably wouldn't have touched a glass of milk, and that was pretty certain.
And to what extent did patterns depend on geography, and why was geography an important factor?
Well, we know now that lactose tolerance is concentrated in Northern Europe, but that doesn't mean that other regions didn't, you know, dairy and didn't drink milk. It's just that the dependence on dairy products as a major feature of diet was very much characterized in the north rather than the south. Nevertheless, I mean, the climate plays into this too.
So whether you're in a place where cows can be raised easily.
Exactly, or goats and sheep.
Goats and sheep.
And goats, again, that's another pasturage animal associated with upland climates, mm-hmm. mountainous territories, which you find in southern places.
Yeah.
So you do have this regional distinction.
Let's talk about some other animals besides cows. I mean, you mentioned goats, you mentioned sheep. What other animal? Actually, I want to talk to you about Mongolia because you have a fascinating little section here talking about the attachment of the Mongols to milk. You say that a container of mare's milk stood at the doorway of every important household, guarded by a minstrel with a guitar. Downing a cupful, the master set off a chain of salutes. A steward on a watch nearby shouted, "Ha!" and the minstrel vigorously strummed his instrument. You go on to say that milk was so important to the Mongols, they often boiled it, then dried and stored the remains in bags for winter consumption. But when mare's milk, they drank the milk of their horses. When mare's milk was in season, you write, Mongols even passed up fresh meat. The steady supply of mare's milk took pride of place as the favorite food of these people. That's really remarkable. Is there anywhere else in the world where milk, regular milk, let alone mare's milk, has that kind of standing?
Well, you know, I'd probably guess, and later on Heather can help me with this, I'd guess that Norwegians and the Finns would probably salute milk with the same enthusiasm. But that story of William of Rubruck and of Carpini, these two 13th century monks who traveled to Mongolia, initially with the idea of converting the natives to Christianity, just captured my imagination instantly, because you really have to sort through the data. There are many accounts of how many mares supplied milk for the daily drink. At one point, it's 3,000. At another point, it's 10,000 mares a day. And there's lots of mythology around who milked the mares. Apparently, only men milked mares. And, you know, they're restive. They're hard to milk. And, of course, you didn't read us the rather rude section about how these mares were actually subdued with some technology. Mm. That, all of this made it down to the Mediterranean and was part of the mythology around these uncivilized Mongols.
Well, Deborah, I'm assuming that since you're an expert on milk and wrote eloquently about the Mongols' love of mare's milk, that you have yourself tried it.
I'm afraid I haven't.
You have not.
I have not. I have to go find some kumis. I understand it's for sale in some parts, but I have not tried it.
Well, why was mare's milk so popular? And what other animals? There are other animals that are pastured. I think of the llamas in South America. What other animals, or are there any, that are used for milk?
Many people have asked me this. Why cow's milk? Why are you writing primarily about cow's milk? And, I was constrained by my historical framework. Cow's milk becomes the commodified milk of the modern world. But nevertheless, I would never underestimate the importance of other animals, particularly goats. And there's an image in the book of hospital nurses holding infants up to asses in order for the infants to nurse directly from the udder at the turn of the 19th century when there was
donkeys.
donkeys. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of concern then about contaminated milk. So yeah. The best way to feed orphans was to bring them to the teat of the animal and let them suck.
Yeah. And at what point does this concern about the safety of milk become a really big issue?
Mm, that's a good question. And
I should say we have Heather Paxton in our studio, professor of anthropology. You've referred to her a couple of times. Heather, I'm going to get to you in a minute. But just in terms of history, Deborah, when does this become an issue?
Well, around 1870 or 1880, Europeans in particular became aware of the fact that the infant mortality rate was rising, mm-hmm. and this had a lot to do with urbanization. The same was true in New York City, where babies were lucky to survive infancy. Much of this seemed to have surround the problem of infant feeding, whether or not it was formula or cow's milk or goat's milk they were being fed. So that's when social reformers, pediatricians, all kinds of food people became concerned about the cleanliness of milk, the milk supply.
This is On Point. I'm Tom Gelton, in for Tom Ashbrook. Today we're talking about milk and what it tells us about industrialization, urbanization, commercialization, and ourselves. Do you remember when the milkman dropped off the bottles on the back porch? Are cheese, ice cream, butter staples in your fridge, in your diet? We're talking with Deborah Valenzi, professor of history at Barnard College. Her new book is Milk, A Local and Global History. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. One more history question for you, Deborah, before we widen this conversation, and that has to do with how important it was when butter and cheese making became common, particularly for commercial purposes.
That's a very important transition in milk history. And it actually goes back to the way in which I got involved in this topic. When I was researching women and work in the Industrial Revolution, I had to look at agricultural labor and the dairy because my whole intention was to show how industrialization isn't simply the importation of machines into production, but a whole new mentality that's imported into the making of goods for the market. So I came upon a how-to manual that had to do with cheese making, but it wasn't written by a dairy farmer. It was written by a cheese factor, the man who went from farm to farm buying up supplies. And in that document, I heard a lot of conversations, voices just leaping out at me from the dairy women themselves who were telling the cheese factor how they did their work. And he was differing with them. And, historians love arguments. This is exactly what I needed. He was saying, this woman is he even calls one of them a fool, because they don't seem to have a scientific method, which they were using to produce their cheese. And he was looking for a predictable product, something he could rely on to bring to the market that would be almost the same every time. He'd ask them, how warm is the milk when you add the rennet? They would say, milk warm. Or he would say, why is this cheese nice and that cheese not so nice? And they wouldn't exactly know, or if they did know, they wouldn't tell him.
But butter and cheese making were activities associated with women at that time.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And they were understood to be ways of preserving milk, preserving the bounty of the month of June. And certainly cheese is thought to be milk made immortal. It can travel, which is something milk can't do so well.
It's portable. I want to bring another voice into the conversation now. With us in the studio, actually, she's been here throughout the hour, is Heather Paxton, an anthropologist at MIT. She studies American artisanal cheesemakers and the culture and politics around raw milk and raw milk cheese. Now, Heather, you're an anthropologist as opposed to a historian, but I'm sure this issue of the differentiated roles between men and women in the dairy industry is something that you have focused on as well.
Yes, that's right. So my story sort of picks up after Deborah's leaves off, I would say. So what happened with cheese production in the States, but elsewhere as well, was after having been part of dairy farming and the chores of farm women, as Deborah has written about, it moved into centralized artisan factories. So area dairy farms would pool their milk together and hire a cheesemaker who would manufacture cheese with their milk collectively, and they would share in those profits. And so as cheese moved out of the household, out of the farm, off the farm and into these factories, the profession was masculinized. And Deborah's written about that very nicely. And what's happened more recently, and this is where my research has picked up, is cheese making is, in a sense, being returned to the farm, but by different people, not by traditional farmers initially. The cheesemaking that I've been studying, the artisan cheesemaking renaissance, as it's referred to often in the U.S. today, sort of got started in the 70s and 80s as an offshoot to the Back to the Land movement, and sort of began with women who raised goats, initially as mothers, milk for their own children. They bred goats. They enjoyed goats. The more goats they had, the more milk they had. And then commercial cheese making sort of became a way of making money off of something that they loved, a passion. And then as new markets opened for artisan cheese, we see new people getting into it. And so the gender dynamic today, we see really a mix of women and men, both doing dairy farming, small-scale dairy farming, and artisan cheese making, sometimes working together and sometimes not.
Now, the big issue for dairy farmers, and it has been for many, many years, is pasteurization. When did pasteurization come into – when was the process of pasteurization really sort of discovered? Deborah, you can maybe help us out here. And how important was it in terms of the evolution of the dairy industry?
Well, you know, one thing my students talk about all the time in my food history course is that the process now known as pasteurization was actually invented by a man named Soxhlet. Mm-hmm. But Soxhlet,
not Louis Pasteur?
No. Well, you know, he was working with beer at the time, and his main concern wasn't about, you know, purifying the milk supply, but it did coincide with a time, again, you know, that would have been the 1860s and 70s in France, where the government stepped in and actually purified milk supplies for the larger populace. Pasteurization, however, developed its equipment. The equipment came into being maybe in the 1890s, 1900. And then it was a big question about who would bear the cost of that, the farmers or the distributors. And it was a considerable cost. And, of course, there was also the debate about why do we need to pasteurize our supply, since plenty of people believe that raw milk was better for you.
And, Heather, this is not exactly a debate that has been resolved one way or another, is it?
Certainly not.
Hey, by the way, are you a post-pasteurian? I've been waiting to ask you that. Because you write that there is a sort of a movement now, a post-pasteurian movement. Explain what that's about.
Well, I call it post-pasteurian. This is a revived excitement, let's say, enthusiasm for raw milk, and it's a very mixed contingency of people who want to be able to purchase and consume and even feed their children raw milk, and it's post-pasteurian insofar as people have sort of taken for granted, I think, a safe milk supply. Mm-hmm. So in the 1930s, when milk became widely pasteurized, this is following, as Deborah was saying, a very high infant mortality, particularly in the cities. And much of that was from contaminated milk. And part of the problem was tuberculosis. So bovine tuberculosis can be manifest in humans. With vaccination of cows, bovine tuberculosis and brucellosis are no longer the threat that they once were. And I think people might take for granted that milk is a safe and natural product. But these days, part of our concern, in terms of the harm, potential harm of raw milk, are new pathogens, toxic E. coli, that didn't exist in the 1930s, that are really the product themselves of industrial dairy farming.
Those are serious concerns, aren't they?
And they certainly are. So the thing is, today, it's hard to even think about milk as a natural product, right? The animals have been so specifically bred.
Uh-huh.
They are fed often things that cows did not evolve to eat. And so milk is not what it always has been. So when we think about, is raw milk better for you or not better for you? Well, produced where? By whom? Under what conditions?
We have a number of callers who have their own thoughts on this issue of raw milk. First of all, Pat is calling us from Aiken, South Carolina. Hello, Pat. You're on the air. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
I just wanted to say that I am a firm believer in raw milk. South Carolina is one of the few states where you can purchase it legally. I've used the same farm for the past 3 years, and during my time of radiation and chemotherapy last year, it was the one product with protein that I could actually tolerate without being sick, and I think it saved my life, and I'm still hooked on it, and I always will be, and I wish it was available for everyone, especially if you know your farmer and you know their practices. You just can't beat it as a natural food.
Well,
that's
Pat,
all I have to say.
We certainly wish you well in your cancer battle. Are you saying that you think that raw milk, as opposed to processed milk, is better for you under the conditions that you're struggling with right now?
Oh yes, oh yes. It has no chemicals, no antibiotics, you know, no growth hormones, no grain. It's just all grass-fed beef locally here from Aiken County, South Carolina.
And do you know your supplier?
I sure do. I know her well.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Well, Heather, that's certainly a strong argument right there.
Well, certainly milk can be produced safely, right? Milk comes out of the udder sterile. The question is the cleanliness of the milking parlor, the health of the animals. And I think Pat made a very good point when she said that she knows personally her producer, and I think that makes a big difference.
Well, that is a really important issue, because people cannot just buy raw milk with when people buy raw milk, they don't always know their producer, their supplier, which is why maybe regulation and the role of government is something to be considered here.
So raw milk is regulated by state.
Mm-hmm.
Unlike cheese, which is regulated by the FDA, fluid milk is regulated by the state. And states differ. In California, you can purchase raw milk in a supermarket, but it might be the only state where you can do that. Many states, it's not possible at all. Some states have interpreted the pasteurized milk ordinance to permit cow shares, whereby people who are interested in consuming raw milk do not legally purchase milk from a farmer, but rather they co-own the cows that a dairy farmer takes care of and milks, and then they collect their ownership portion of that fluid milk. So the question of regulation right now is very heterogeneous.
Let's go now to Philip, who's calling from Bordeaux, France. Hello, Philip. Bonjour.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Well, I'm a hello. Can you hear me?
Yeah. What's the outlook on milk in Bordeaux?
I think you prefer wine,
if I'm not mistaken.
I'm a Massachusetts native, and that's one of the issues that keeps coming up living here. Milk is not at all the staple commodity that it is at home.
I don't know if I would be drinking milk if I lived in Bordeaux either.
Yeah, exactly. You're telling me. But even to the extent, when I go home to visit family, there's without a doubt 2 fresh gallons of milk in the fridge ready to go. And over here, we pick up our milk maybe in a half pint bottle, unrefrigerated on the shelf. It's not used in coffee. So it's kind of one of the pet peeves out of all the things I miss from home. Without a doubt, milk ranks up there. It's often a bone of contention between my roommate and I about how awful the quality is over here.
Well, Deborah Valenzi or Heather Paxson, how do you explain why milk is drunk to the extent it is in the United States and not in another similar industrial country like France?
Well, you know, I would say that it's a good idea to get across the English Channel or up to Scandinavia, where there certainly would be a quart or even a gallon of milk in the fridge. But, you know, America's history, love affair with milk goes back to the colonial times. And as we know, food habits are very much ingrained in customs and economies in which inhabitants live. So I would say that America's love of milk really has a lot to do with history as much as, you know, what you see in the supermarket and hear on commercials on TV.
Okay, let's go now to Susan, who's calling us from Minneapolis, Minnesota. Susan, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Beautiful day here. I hope it's the same for where you are.
It's a beautiful day here in Boston, too.
I was calling just with going back to some of the historical perspective that the professor set. I've traveled in Mongolia the last three summers, and I've watched milk curds being dried on the roof of gares, doing a little research about the role of milk and just the kind of life, the nomadic life that still exists in Mongolia. There's a great book by Professor Jack Weatherford called Genghis Khan and the Making of the Modern World, in which his research helps us share and understand that the armies of Genghis Khan were as successful as they were because they dried milk curd and kept it in their saddlebags and fed themselves and their horses as their massive armies moved across Asia. And I was wondering, it was fascinating to me to watch both husbands and wives milk their horse herds, but it was a joint
endeavor
that mm-hmm. I observed in the last 3 years.
Interesting. Deborah, does this ring bells for you?
Well, it does. It first of all, your example is perfect, a portable milk, which is a dried curd. And, you know, there is fossil evidence of such things going on in prehistory.
How long does dried milk last in that form?
Heather, do you know?
Long enough for them to take it in their saddlebags on a journey, clearly.
Easily, and it probably didn't last longer than a year because people would have been consuming it.
Sure.
I'm glad to hear that customs of milking mares have now admitted women into the ranks of the labor population. It makes perfect sense that you know, this image of men only belonged to part of that mythology swirling around mare's milk in the distant past.
Heather, is whey dried milk curds still produced? Is it making a comeback in some quarters by any chance?
Well, milk. Cheese curds in Wisconsin, of course, are enjoyed as a snack food, often flavored and sold in bags. And Wisconsinites often have their creamery where they drive miles to get the curd that they most prefer. As far as I know, Wisconsin's the only curd-eating area in the states. Whey, however, which is a byproduct of cheese making, is an important substance, and I think we should think of it, and certainly the small cheesemakers that I work with often think of it not as a waste product, but as a resource. They use it to fertilize pastures. They feed it to pigs. Whey-fed pork is an important part of a farmstead economy. And, of course, at the industrial level, it's powdered and used in protein bars.
This is On Point. I'm Tom Gelton, in for Tom Ashbrook. Today we're talking about milk, cheese, and the future of dairy farming. Lori has already sent in a web comment on our website. She says, I milk goats and use the milk for soap making, cheese making, and family milk consumption. Because I use raw milk and don't have a $10,000 stainless steel facility, I cannot sell cheese or milk at the farmer's market. It's so frustrating Where is the support for small farms? We're going to be getting into that very issue in this segment. We've got a terrific panel with us today. Deborah Valenzi is here with her new book, Milk, A Local and Global History. Also here is Heather Paxson, who studies raw milk cheesemakers. And I'd like now to bring in Carl Klesse, joining us from Cleveland, Wisconsin. He's a fifth-generation farmer at Saxon Homestead Farm and Creamery. Last year, their washed rind cheese won first place at the American Cheese Society. Carl, thank you for joining us.
Hi, Tom.
Did I get that correct? Washed rind cheese?
That's correct. That's one of the types of cheeses we produce.
What is washed rind cheese? I've never heard of it.
Yeah, it's a process whereby the cheese is produced, and then it's put in a brine solution, a salt solution. It forms a skin on the outer rind, and then it's painted with bacterium to enhance flavor in the cheese as it's aging. And our cheeses are raw milk cheeses, and they age for a minimum of 60 days as required by the FDA.
So I wanted to ask you about that, Carl. What is needed if you are going to make raw milk cheese as you do and sell it legally? What are the steps, the procedure that you have to go through?
Great question. The state of Wisconsin is very much concentrated its efforts within the dairy industry. We are really the mecca of the dairy industry in the United States. Our state produces over 600 types and varieties of cheeses. And most recently, in the last 10 years, there's been a very concentrated effort to produce high-quality artisanal cheeses. And many of these cheeses are made by smaller producers, many of them farmstead producers, and there are very stringent requirements in milk quality so that the farms are tightly regulated, and the plants that produce the cheeses are tightly regulated by the state and the federal government as well. So high quality is really dependent upon very healthy cows, a healthy environment, high-quality milk, and then stringent production requirements of those cheeses.
Well, Carl, your family has been with this farm operation now into its fifth generation. Can I ask you about, if it's not too direct, the viability of your enterprise? Is it getting harder to do what you do there, to produce these artisanal cheeses as you do? What is the competitive environment, the economic environment, the business environment in which you're operating like now?
The dairy community nationwide has concentrated on high volume cheeses that are many times made from pasteurized milk, or primarily made from pasteurized milk, and the objective is to turn out high quality products that are safe and nutritious. Where we've desired to go and have gone is to produce that next echelon of cheeses that are very high quality in flavor and texture, that are also safe, and that many times require much more hand labor to produce. And that's the competitive nature of our business, really is dependent upon reaching the market that desires these cheeses, like high quality wine. And that puts on a very high standard and burden for us in extra costs. So consequently, many times these cheeses cost more. So with that increased quality, and it is very competitive as we produce cheese for that market share.
Are large agribusiness corporations not interested in that business?
I think that they are very interested in producing these artisanal cheeses. But clearly they rely on smaller, more specialized operations to provide that product for them.
So you sell to wholesalers. You sell wholesale as well as retail, or
that's correct. And we sell nationwide. And our first barrage or our first emphasis was to sell to small local specialty cheese and dairy shops and gain market share by marketing to larger, high-quality specialty food stores like Whole Foods, like Kroger's, and penetrate that market as well.
And Carl, do you sell milk as well, or are you focused exclusively on making artisanal cheeses right now?
We are focused on making artisanal cheeses. We do not sell raw milk.
And when did you make that? I mean, I presume that historically your farm had been involved in selling milk. Is that correct?
That's correct. And we do sell milk. Just a bit about our farm. We are a fifth-generation farm. Our farm was actually homesteaded in 1850, so on July 7th of this year, it'll be 161 years old. It's a pasture-based farm. We milk about 500 cows. We have 850 acres of pasture for those cows. And we've concentrated on a more natural, environmentally friendly agricultural system to produce high-quality milk for our cheeses.
And your entire milk production goes to cheesemaking?
Yes, it does. A small portion of about 15% of our milk actually goes to make our cheeses, and then the remaining 85% of our milk production goes to another local cheese factory that makes string cheese. It's pasteurized, and they make a very high-quality string cheese for the marketplace.
I have to ask you, Carl, do you have any complaints about government regulations? Do you have any concerns that you think the government should be addressing, from your perspective as a dairy producer?
Because the state of Wisconsin has a long history of dairy production, the infrastructure here in the state of Wisconsin with the University of Wisconsin, the Department of Agriculture, and the private sector have really come together in a very cohesive, strong way to produce high-quality dairy products. So I really don't have complaints. I'm very enthused, by and large, with the effort of the industry to produce the dairy products that we do. It's an incredibly deep industry with lots of experience and lots of knowledge in the dairy production field.
Well, if you would just be willing to stay with us for a few more minutes, Carl, I want to get to some callers. I'm going to start out with Martin, who's calling from Williamsburg, Virginia. Martin, welcome to On Point.
Hello, Tom. I'm going to talk fast. I've
Good.
Got a lot to say here in this thing. I've been, for years, I bought from a local dairy that made non-homogenized milk. And I made an extra trip to buy that milk. And I read years ago a book correlating the incidence of atherosclerotic disease in our society with the consumption of homogenized milk.
Because of high cholesterol, I guess.
The physiology underlying this, there's an enzyme in cow's milk, xanthine oxidase. This is an oxidizing enzyme that's hard on the endothelial layer of the blood vessels.
Now, don't get too technical on us.
Well, I am, because that's where this is. So if this gets in your circulation, it increases the incidence of atherosclerosis. And this was an epidemiologic study showing the correlation of the incidence of atherosclerosis in different societies, countries, with the incidence of consumption of homogenized milk and the duration of where that was the primary milk consumed. Now, the reason for that is because the homogenization makes chylomicrons. These are small particles of fat that stay in suspension. And the reason they do that is because the increases the shelf life of the milk, mm-hmm. and it makes it a lot more palatable, and it doesn't spoil as quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why the benefit of homogenizing milk. Now, mm-hmm. the problem with homogenizing milk is that this small chylomicrons get absorbed in the portal circulation. They get absorbed differently. Regular fats in your body, when you eat fat, your intestine breaks it down, puts it through the intestinal barrier, and then reconstructs it again. And the antigenic properties, for one thing, they're less antigenic properties. But another thing that happens when you do that is that the enzyme is not active. So when you've got chylomicrons, this enzyme gets sucked right in the portal circulation, gets in your body, and then it works on your lining of your arteries.
Okay, Martin, before you lose us, I want to bring this question up to our panel. Let's start with Deborah or Heather. When was homogenization introduced? Do you have any rough idea? And do you have any thoughts about safety issues related to homogenization, Heather?
I'm not a dairy scientist or a physician. I would like to go back to what Carl Klesik was saying, if that's okay. Because I think he laid out very nicely some of the political economics that the dairy industry is looking at today. And Wisconsin, I think, deserves a lot of credit for its ability to, or its willingness to help think differently about how to support dairy farming in that state. So the license plates in Wisconsin say America's Dairyland, and dairying is very important to the self-identity of Wisconsin. A few years ago, it became clear that California was going to outcompete, outproduce Wisconsin in terms of volume of milk. And the Happy Cows Come From California ads were sort of the final straw. And in response, Wisconsin has really thrown its support behind value-added dairy processing on farms like the Klesigs. So as you said...
By value-added, you mean taking a product like milk and making it more valuable through processing it into cheese, et cetera.
Exactly. So Klesigs are a fifth generation dairy farm, but a first generation cheese producing farm. The difference is, you know, so farming is the only business where you buy everything retail and sell everything wholesale. And it's a very difficult business because of that. So the idea with value-added dairy production is it allows the farmer to recoup some of that retail value by doing processing on the farm. And cheese making is very appealing for a couple reasons. Not only does it add value to the milk, commodity milk prices are pennies on the 100 pound, whereas cheese, you know, you get a lot more for the money, but it also stabilizes the value of milk because the cheese markets fluctuate less wildly than the fluid dairy commodity markets. So they can do business planning. They can plan for the future. It's not a panacea. It's not an easy business to break into. It requires skills, not just cheesemaking skills, but marketing skills that traditional dairy farmers haven't had. They have to deal with people and not mm-hmm. just, you know, meet the milk truck as it comes to pick up the milk.
Right.
But this is where Wisconsin has really been helping dairy farmers.
Well, I'm afraid we're going to disappoint Martin, who wanted to know about homogenization, but this is just as interesting. Carl, did you make the decision to convert into 100% cheese making, or was that made by an earlier generation?
This is a great question, Heather, and I have to remind you that my great-great-grandmother was the first cheesemaker and had the first generation or developed the cheese factory on our farm. Generation 2 also made cheese on our farm. And then 3 and 4 concentrated on industrial egg.
Right.
And now we're sort of bringing it all back. We went back to grazing. We think that's a much healthier system for our cattle. It's definitely easier on the environment. Again, Wisconsin has made this existential effort to value add and help producers and help the processing industry get back into artisanal cheese making. So that's been a really, really important thing. Tom, in answer to your question, it was definitely a group decision. My sister Elise, my brother Robert, our families, my brother-in-law and partner Jerry, all contributed and helped make the decision for us to start the cheese factory that we have.
And when was that, Carl?
In 2007, we actually started producing cheese.
So up until 2007, you were a more traditional dairy farmer.
That's correct, Tom. From 1929 to 2007, we did not produce cheese on our farm. And I think that the average dairy farmer in our state is really removed from the marketplace, and it's very hard to produce milk and then also touch the marketplace. So we've really sort of lost our connection to the marketplace. And that's really at the heart of being a successful artisan cheesemaker, is touching that marketplace and having the expertise and the support, which really is provided in Wisconsin to do that existential leap.
Well, Carl, we wish you good fortune with your enterprise there. Carl Klesig, farmer at Saxon Homestead Farm and Creamery, thanks for joining us. We've also heard from Deborah Valenze, the author of Milk, A Local and Global History. You can read an excerpt on our website, onpointradio.org. Thanks, Deborah, for being here. And Heather Paxson, an anthropologist studying artisanal cheesemaking, it was great to have you. You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org, and you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Tom Gelton, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.